I am not up here to give my talk, but I am going to give you a little portion of how I first met our speaker. I had rolled into an AA meeting from Miami in hot pants and high white go-go boots and a long blonde fall, a human hair fall. I paid $100 for it. And the reason I wore that is because my hair was drunk. However, my hair was not blonde in the front. Then, of course, we had this mass of brownish roots and then this long blonde fall. And at that meeting, there was a man there who smelled me coming from the parking lot. He was a finger pointer. His name was John Gibbons, and he's deceased now. And he pointed his finger at me, and I wanted to bite it off. He kept doing this at me, and he asked me how much I drank. And for the first time, I had been honest, and I said, well, I've been drinking about a half gallon a day. And he turned sheet white, and he said, oh, honey, you need medical help. He said, we have a doctor who sees alcoholics after hours. Well, I knew a lot of men like that. And I didn't understand the concept that we speak of ourselves in the present tense. He said, this doctor is an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he will see you and treat you. And so my vision of this doctor I was going to go meet was a four-day growth of beard, a wrinkled suit, a syringe hanging out of his arm, and a bottle on the desk. And I really thought this John was kind of crazy if you wanted me to go see somebody like that. But I did make an appointment with that doctor who saw me after hours, and was on a Saturday morning. And he put his arms around me, and he told me it was okay, that if I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and did what folks told me to do, that I too could get sober. I could not imagine a life without alcohol. I didn't know how you coped. I don't know how you went grocery shopping. I didn't know how to do anything. And this man encouraged me to keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And while there at the meeting, at this office visit, he told me a little bit about himself, how he had been tied down to a table in a hospital one time, that it was his dream to build a hospital where the alcoholic could be treated with love and dignity and good medical care. And as sick as I was, I said, if you ever build that hospital, I want to go there and work with you. He did, and I did. As an aside here, I talked to my daughter, who's up dog-sitting our house, and we're staying at her house. She's pregnant, 5 months pregnant, and she's feeling very nostalgic. And she actually wanted to be here to hear Dr. Hunter, but she couldn't because she was babysitting dogs. And she was looking through the family Bible, and she said, you'll never know what I ran across. And I said, what? And she said, it's your formal letter of application to Dr. Hunter. And I had followed it up, my verbal application. She said, I wish we had a fax machine so I could fax it to you this morning. God touches us in many ways, and there are no coincidences. It is amazing. I had no idea that letter was in there. And why it turned up last night is one of God's doings. This man has meant an awful lot to me, and I thoroughly enjoyed working for him and with him. It was a long, long association. Glenn and I met Glenn, my husband, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and many groups said it'll never last. Well, as on Tuesday we're going to celebrate our 25th anniversary, they may be right. It may not last. But we kind of do that one day at a time, too. Without further ado, I would like all of you to give a warm welcome to a wonderful member of this fellowship, Conway H.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Conway. I am an alcoholic. I am a physician. I'm married and the father of five wonderful children. And this is always the way that I begin my talk, by telling you who I am and what I am. And you'll notice, and it's our custom, but especially is mine, that I say that I'm an alcoholic first. This is the most important thing in my life. Because I know that any time that I should ever forget that I'm an alcoholic, that I have the disease of alcoholism, I would probably go back to what I was. I was the loneliest, the sickest, the sorriest, most miserable, frightened human being that you can imagine. But today, thanks to the love, the mercy of a kind and a forgiving God, the strength, the hope, the love of people just like you and you, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to be ashamed of me anymore. I don't have to run. I don't have to hide. I don't have to lie. And I don't have to cheat. And this is the way I live my life today. And I live a life of joy. I live a life of gratitude. And there's so many things that I have to tell you today that I am so grateful for. Not the least of which is the fact that you, the faithful few, are here this morning. But God has been so good to me, and it's been such a wonderful life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and with so many of you people that are here. Coming back here this morning and being here and for the meeting that we have, it's just been a wonderful experience for me. It's like a homecoming, because there's so many of you here that played and play such a very important part in my life. So many of you have given me so much. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come to be here, and this morning it is a real honor to speak at this room. I think we've just had a fantastic program and a wonderful group of speakers, and let's all give the committee and the speakers a big hand. Now let's all go home. No, I do believe in following the guidelines of the Big Book, where it says we share in a gentle way our experience, strength, and hope. Because you see, that's all that I have to offer to you, is a sum total of my life's experiences. What happened, and what's happening today. I was born and raised here in Atlanta. I lived here almost all my life. My father was a doctor, my mother was a teacher, and I had an older sister. I had a wonderful childhood up until about the age of 12. Somewhere along about the age of 12, and we heard this before, was when I first realized that I was different from other people. Now, I don't know how to explain this. Not a feeling of being superior, not a feeling of being inferior. Just me and my things were different from other people. Well, you could all be in a room and be laughing and talking and having a good time, and I came in and I didn't belong. Something was missing in me. I wasn't complete. I wasn't a whole person. And I searched everywhere I could to find this missing ingredient, whatever it was, and I wasn't able to find that until you found me. I took my first drink, though, when I was about 5 years old, and that was when I had the whooping cough. Now, whooping cough was a real serious illness back then. A lot of people died from the whooping cough. Well, I had the whooping cough. And I remember it real well. I remember running down the hall and grabbing my daddy around his leg, standing there, and my little body was racking in these spasms of cough. And he took me into the bathroom, stood me up on the sink, poured out about that much alcohol and gave it to me, and immediately the coughing stopped. So you see, my very first experience with alcohol, it solved a need, it gave me relief, and I could sleep. And I think that's interesting. I don't think it's got a thing in the world to do with me being an alcoholic, but it's interesting. What's significant is the fact that I remember it so well. This is something that happened 64 years ago. 64 and 5, 69. It is a significant event in our lives when we are first united with this magic elixir. And how many times you hear an alcoholic talking and talking about his very first drink, you know, and where he was, what he did before, what he did afterwards, who was there, how much it costs, and everything about it. You know, you don't remember your first root beer or your first chocolate milk. It is a significant event in our lives. But anyhow, I didn't drink anymore for a while. I went on. I did real well. I was an overachiever, and my mother was a teacher. And so she spent a lot of time with me, teaching me how to study, which was the main ingredient. So it wasn't that I was so smart, but I had to step up on everybody. And I usually was at the top of the class. And I enjoyed the praises that came along with it. So I was willing to put in the work that it took. Well, I did real well, finished school. My mother became quite ill during my childhood and died from a progressive type of disease, debilitating condition. And this was a great loss to me. But I went on and went to high school and did real well there and went into college. And I met the most beautiful girl in the world. She was the prettiest thing that you ever saw. She had real black hair and real dark skin. And her eyes were so brown that you couldn't even see the pupils in them. And it was a storybook romance. And I love this girl. I still love this girl. We got married and we had two children. She too developed a chronic and a progressive illness. And first she went insane and then she died. So you see, the two really most powerful people in my life, I lost about that time. My father, of course, was, and I'll tell you more about him as we go along. But now I was in college and I was drinking quite a bit, and it was progressing. And then I was entered into medical school. Now, this was a significant event in my life. I had accomplished this goal that I'd set out, was to get into medical school, and it wasn't an easy thing to do back then. Well, I did, and I began to drink more and more and more. And as a result of this, my grades began to deteriorate, and I dropped from the top of the class down to the bottom of the class. I finally did graduate, though, and then they sent me to do my internship. I went to Grady Hospital. Now, I know most of you know Grady Hospital, but it was a real experience for me then, as one of the nurses that I worked with down there sitting right here. And that's a warm thing, too. But here I graduated from medical school on June the 1st, I guess it was. And then I was sent down to Grady on June the 2nd. And we were turned loose on the people. Now, this was during the wartime. There's a tremendous shortage of everything. There were only four surgery interns for the entire Grady Hospital. And it was a real awesome experience. So that, you know, we came in just sort of like a shot from a gun or a spun dry doctor, just right out. And it was wonderful. I mean, we worked 36 hours on, we had 12 hours off, and it was go, 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 bookity, bookity, bookity the whole time. Emergency room to the delivery room to the orthopedic floor to the ambulance. So we rode the ambulance back in those days, and I loved it. I loved it. You see, for the very first time in my life, I'm providing a service to mankind. Now, I wasn't much, but I was all they had, and they appreciated it. And working the hours that we were working, that when the 12 hours off came, I was so tired, the only thing I was interested in was going home and going to sleep. I stopped drinking during this period of time. And I think that's nothing in the world except a stopgap. In the progression of my disease of alcoholism, I stopped drinking. It takes two things to make an alcoholic. One with a condition and alcohol. You put the two together and you get the alcoholism. I stopped drinking. I spent 2 years there in general surgery, and then I went into my specialty. I am a specialist. I'm a ladies' doctor. I never fail to take the opportunity in the presence of so many beautiful women. I want to thank you because you've been so good to me and my family. We appreciate it. And it was a wonderful type of work. And being at birth and creation and all of that. And I really loved it. And as Natalie told you, after a while I stopped doing that, and I haven't for a long time. And for about 30 years now, I've worked in recovery. But as it was, I spent the next 5 years at Graded, first assistant to the Stork. Then I met one of the nurses there, and I got married. And then I got drafted, sort of in like in that autumn. They don't really draft doctors. They send you a telegram, and they say you better. And I knew what the alternative was on this, so I quickly enlisted, and they sent me to Fort Sam, Houston, Texas. And that's where they send all doctors to make soldiers out of them. Now, they didn't have any idea of making a soldier out of us anyhow. It was nothing in the world except a 6 weeks vacation at pay, with pay. The pay thing was important because all those years at Grady Hospital, all we got was $10 a month and all the milk you could drink, and that was it. But now I'm an officer and I'm a gentleman and I have a salary and uniforms and a very significant thing, very significant. All the shooting wars had stopped. And this was one of those windows where everybody was celebrating the victory, you know. Well, I arrived at Fort Sam, and I said, it was the bands and the parades and the uniforms and the flags and the nickel beer and the bingo parties and the martini parties. It was party time all the time. You never had to have had a look. It was Miller time all the time. You never had to look for a party. You were in one. And it was great. Well, I spent my time there and received orders to go to Orleans, France. Now, I never got to France. I was to be in charge of a base hospital in France, a MASH unit, but I never got there. I got all the way to the Pentagon and was issued new orders. I had to go back. I got all the way to Fort Dix from the Pentagon and go back to the Pentagon and was issued new orders and sent to Fort Eustis, Virginia. That's the transportation headquarters of the United States Army. Well, this was wonderful because I wasn't going to have to leave. I was going to be able to stay in the States and stay with my people and all that, and my children. And so I remember driving down from Washington down through the Tidewater country, you know, to Fort Eustis, right close to Williamsburg. And it's that beautiful country. But you know, when things are going your way, you notice the natural beauty that's present there too. I mean, the sky is a bluer blue and the grass is green and you notice the birds are singing and things. Your whole world is just up when things are going your way, and that was it. And I was tooling along and come in. I pull into this post and the MP stopped me and asked for my orders. And I gave him my orders and they went in a little command post and came out and lined up. They gave me a snappy salute. I said, boy, this is a Class A outfit here. Unknown to me, the reason my orders were changed and I was reassigned, the commanding general's wife was pregnant and expecting a baby. And I was the one responsible for this military emergency. From the moment I drove through those gates, I was the commanding general's wife's doctor. Now, wherever the commanding general went, commanding general's wife went, commanding general's wife's doctor went. We took the yacht out on the James River, commanding general, commanding general's wife, commanding general's wife's doctor. Took the helicopters to New York, commanding general, commanding general's wife, commanding general's wife's doctor. Sort of like a mascot, you know, they pulled along on a string. And I will have to say that she finally did have a nice baby boy, who I am sure someday will be a commanding general just like his father and his grandfather. This will have to go as my contribution to the defense of the United States. But I loved Army life. Anybody with an assignment like mine would. And I probably would have stayed in the Army except for this childhood dream, this ambition that I wanted to come back and work with my father. And my father, my friends, and my hero. And he still is. As far as I'm concerned, that's the greatest mortal man that's ever walked the face of this earth. He was the kindest and the gentlest and the greatest healer and the greatest teacher that I've ever known. I was so privileged to have this man. And we had some wonderful times together. We also had some very tragic times together. But anyhow, if you'll get the picture, I'm a native son. I went to medical school there. I'm trained in the city hospital. Father has a large practice, an excellent reputation. And I come back onto the scene. The members of the medical community literally rolled out the carpet to welcome me back. And I was put on board committees and duties and assignments, and I was teaching and all of this. And my ego was about out of sight, so I thought they were doing what they should. All except my father. And my father was standing right there beside me all day, all the time, everywhere I went and everything that I did. He was looking over my shoulder. He didn't trust me, and I resented this. Here I was, a young hero returning from the wars, received the finest training in the country, and he didn't trust me. I was ready to take over and put him out in the pasture, you know. And now my wife started having children, babies, and I resented this. I wasn't ready to assume the responsibility and the duty and the obligation of having these children. I wasn't ready for that. So I resented this, and I resented her for having them. I guess I thought she did it all by herself. But now you see what I've done. I've turned away from the only two people that were really close to me. Alcoholics are perfect geniuses to hurt the ones that we love and we need the most. But at that time, I don't think I needed anybody, or I didn't think I did, and I didn't know what love was. So I came back, and during the next 3 years, I guess 2 years, 3 years, I don't know how long, I did almost every horrible thing that you have ever heard of an alcoholic doing, because my drinking had accelerated to such a point that it was dominating my life. This is the point where I cross over that invisible but completely irreversible line into the disease of active alcoholism. Once you go across that line, my friends, you never come back the other way. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You never become unalcoholic. Or as one of our friends says, once a cucumber becomes a pickle, you never go back to being a cucumber again. And I was well pickled. As it happened, so, and during this time, as I said, I did every horrible thing that you can imagine. And I'm not ashamed of that. I'm sorry for the people that I hurt. My children bear scars that will never be erased. But neither are they ashamed of the fact, too. Because you see, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I am not responsible for my illness, any more so than I would be if I had diabetes or colitis or enteritis or any one of another 30 or 40 diseases I name, of which there does not seem to be a known cause. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But now that I do know what's wrong with me, I am responsible for my recovery. Anybody that was living the life that I was living and doing the things that I was doing, something had to happen to, and it did. Monday morning, October the 1st of 1962, I had a massive heart attack. And I was taken to the hospital for a while. They didn't know if I would live, and I certainly didn't know if I would ever be able to work again. I became very depressed and very bitter. And this is where I turned against God. Why did you do this to me? Here I've spent all these years, all this time, all this money, now just to be a place to be of service to you, to me, to mankind. And you cast me down here in the bed, helpless. Not even able to bathe myself. The height of indignity. I cursed God. I denounced God. I became consumed with fear and hate. Don't send me any cards. Don't send me any flowers. Leave me alone. Can't you see how I suffer? Leave me alone. It's a wonder I didn't kill myself. I did get better. I left the hospital. But to continue my recovery, I moved down to live with my sister. My sister lived on a little island off the coast of Georgia called St. Simon's Island. I moved down there to stay with her for a while. I want to take a minute or two to tell you about St. Simon's Island because it plays a very important part in my recovery both then and now. I live down there now. And you drive down, and when you go over the causeway and you go over the real high bridges and you look on the last bridge and you look down over the island, and the first thing that you notice is just the natural beauty that's present there. The rich, luxurious green, the flora, the fauna. These trees, these massive trees, the great pine tree rises straight into the air. It's regal in its nature, it's majestic in its bearing. And the wind blows, and these great old pines will creak and they will groan. And underneath the pine is the live oak, the personification of strength and of power and of solidarity. And in the tops of the trees is the Spanish moss. And the wind blows and the moss dances. And there's beauty in the wind. There's music in the air. And there's a certain feeling of peace and serenity there that I have never found any place else. And I know for me that the reason is I know when I'm there, I am closer to my God. It's a very special place, this enchanted little island. I'm not the only one that feels that way. And if you haven't ever been, I want you to come and share with us the serenity and the tranquility and the power that's present in this hallowed ground. Well, I stayed down there for a while with her, and I got better, and I came back to go to work. But you know, anybody's had any trouble with their heart's not supposed to get nervous. And everybody knows that a heart patient has to sleep a good night's sleep every night. So I had tranquilizers to keep me calm and sleeping pills to make sure I slept, and I washed it down with a bottle of scotch every night. Now, I don't think they meant for me to do that all at the same time. But this now is where I start treating me as a doctor. And whenever a doctor starts treating himself as a patient, the patient has got a fool for a doctor. But I also, this is a point in time where I enter into that magic world of living totally by chemistry. And I feel fully qualified to speak as a drug addict. I took everything that was out at that time except Miles Nervine and Lydia Pinkham. And I would have taken them too if they'd come in samples. You see. You know, people are talking about drugs and they always worry about drugs and getting drugs. I never had to do that. The only thing I had to do was open a drawer or go to a closet and reach in. You know, red ones, green ones, pink ones, blue ones, speckled ones, you know, uppers and downers. They got a new one now called tricyclic. Makes you go all three ways. I took some of all of them, though. I quickly learned, though, not to take them unless they had warning, maybe habit forming. The rest of those will make you sick. I do want to say a word or two about this, because I think it's one of the most dangerous things those of us who have problems with alcohol and addiction face today. And I'm speaking of the phenomenon of cross-tolerance and cross-addiction that we occur. It just is beyond reason why some people can think that just because they can't drink alcohol, it's all right for them to do this or do that, or they can't smoke, can't do marijuana, so it's okay to have a few beers. There's no way, my friends. There's no way. I know I am a total addict. And I could get addicted to an empty capsule if you told me it'd make me feel good. So if I ever decide to go back to taking any drugs or anything, I'm not going to fool around with any Elavil, or Melaril, or Trancine, or Cerax, or Librium, or Valium, or Prozac, or any one of the other no-name things that I could throw out there. I'm just going to go to my drug of choice. My drug of choice is Scotch whiskey. I say it with reverence. That's the finest drug that there ever was. It did everything for me I have drug ever would do. Just the thought of it now just sort of, you know, really go reaches in and warms the cockles of my heart. I just think about it as it goes down, you know, I went down so well and I got down there and it the world became brighter and lighter and you all got a lot better. And there it was. And they would do it again, I expect. but it also took everything in the world that was important to me away from me. I might last 5 minutes. I don't know. It wouldn't matter. I just don't think I'm going to try it. So I'm not going to try any of these other things. I'm just going to start off with scotch, but it'll be a swimming pool full. I know I can get drunk again, but I also know there's no more getting sober for me. And that's okay. And I'm happy with that. But anyhow, I came back and I'm drinking again and taking these drugs and all. Some interesting things happened. As you can imagine, they called me to come down to the hospital one night in the middle of the night. Now, I wasn't on call, and this was not my patient, but they needed somebody of my training and my experience, so they called me to come down in the middle of the night for this big emergency, and I said, all right. And I got up, and I threw on my clothes, and I got in my car, and I raced down the expressway, ego running wild. I'm a doctor on emergency, you see. And I pull into the emergency room, and I leave the lights on, the car doors open, the motor running, and I go in some sort of a combination of Walter Mitty and Superman. Have no fear, Conway is here. Well, I went in, and I took charge of the case, and the case went real well. You know, one of the last things that we lose is our ability to perform and our trained skills. We're usually the best that there is anyhow. We have to be. We're working two jobs there. The case went well, and I would have been all right if I'd kept my mouth shut. But no practicing alcoholic's going to keep his mouth shut. I had to tell them how lucky they were to have me down there. The next morning I came to go to work, you know, fully expecting a hero's welcome, and I didn't get that. I noticed people were standing around in little groups, and they were whispering to each other, and they were looking at me. They were looking at me sort of slaunch-eyed. Now, whenever they're doing that, they're talking about you. They were talking about me. It didn't take long to find out. I got called down to the administrator's office and said, don't ever come back to this hospital under the influence. Well, I'd sobered up enough to keep my mouth shut, so I didn't say anything. But I went out and I got in my car, and I was driving on over to my office. And driving over to the office, I got to thinking about this. Now, thinking, my friends, to me is one of the most dangerous things an alcoholic can do. My thinking's what got me into this. You know, you go in AA club rooms and you see those signs, think, think, think. I think they ought to put a big red circle and a line across. That's the last thing an alcoholic ought to do. And Sandy said, sit on the front row and shut up and listen. You haven't got anything. But anyhow, I got to thinking about it. Just got filled up with righteous indignation. Here I went down to the hospital in the middle of the night, and I saved that woman's life. And these narrow-minded, unappreciative people were talking about those two, three little drinks I had. I reached up under the seat, and I got that bottle of hot vodka. If there are any of you that have not experienced the thrill of drinking hot vodka, I don't recommend it. That sends chills up my spine, right? But it does have authority. If you ever get one of those to stay down, you're in control the rest of the day. But the insanity of it all, see, I didn't see that I had done anything wrong. They didn't appreciate me. But even with all these things going on, you know as it happens to us alcoholics, I kept falling up the stairs. I kept getting promoted, you know, and elevated. I got put on the executive committee of the whole hospital. Now, they called me to come to this executive committee meeting. I remember it was in December, right before Christmas. It was very cold in Atlanta that morning, and I put on a suit, an overcoat, a muffler, gloves, and dark glasses. Now, this was before daylight. And it was before shades was cool. And I went down to this meeting. Now, this meeting is the chief of everything. You know, they had a surgery and all this, and they're sitting around there in these little fold-up chairs, church chairs, you know, and they're sitting. And I don't know what they were doing before I got there, but as soon as I walked in, it all stopped. And I was dressed exactly as I described, and I went over and I sat down, the only little chair left. And once again, they all started staring at me. I knew they were looking at me. I didn't know what to do, so I passed out. This really shook them up, you know. They knew I'd had this trouble in my heart, and they said, "Oh, my Lord, he's dead." And one big old fella had me up in his arms, you know, and they're pulling my collar loose, and they're putting oxygen over my nose, and bells were ringing, and sirens were blowing, and they were knocking those chairs around, and I was coming in and out of consciousness saying, "Please let it be a dream." It wasn't any dream. When I woke up, they had me in an oxygen tent, and they had something hooked up to everything you can hook up something to. And then I was lying like that, and then the doctors and the nurses came in. The doctors, and they ran the heart tracing. They looked at the heart tracing. They listened to the heart, and then they frowned. There wasn't anything wrong with the heart. I was a medical mystery. I solved the mystery for them. I went into the DTs. I was running up and down the hall, that hall of that hospital, you know, in that little gown that doesn't quite. It was me and the nurses and the orderlies, and it was Christmas time, and there was reindeers and Santa Claus and elves and angels, and some of it was real, some of it wasn't. But it was all real to me. And I woke up one morning there, and you know how we have these, even in a fog, these moments of clarity, and it comes through, you know. And I realized it was Christmas. And I said, "I'm going to go home and be with my children for Christmas." They said, "No, you aren't." I said, "Yes, I am. This is a hospital, not a jail, and you can't keep me here." I said, "Yes, we can." But anyhow, they called my father, and he came and got me to take me to the local drunk hospital on Christmas Day. Now, I remember entering this hospital, but I never remember leaving the hospital, because they did all the wrong things that you can do. They gave me more and more drugs, and this is where I lost my mind. I don't remember much at all about what happened there. The things that I do remember, none of them are pleasant. I remember being stripped and tied down and big straps across my chest and left alone in a room. I remember the straitjacket. I remember the convulsions and the pain in the back. And one night when I was tied down and having the convulsions, they couldn't get them stopped. And the nurse called the doctor in charge, said, "What must we do? We can't stop the convulsions." His reply was, "Let him die. He's a hopeless alcoholic." It's not as bad as it sounds. You see, they didn't know what else to do for me. Let him die. Put him out of his misery. I remember the screams. I remember the fear. I remember waking up and looking at my hands and seeing the blood encrusted around my nails from where I tried to claw my way out of the closet I was hiding in. I remember the screams. Those were my screams. And may I never forget it. May I never forget it. And that's why I had the dream to build that hospital, where alcoholics would be treated with dignity and respect. We're alcoholics. Alcoholism is an illness. It's a medical illness, and it deserves good medical care. We are not lepers. I stayed down there a little while, then I left once again to go back down to stay on St. Simon's Island. And this time I had to have somebody send me. The people took me down there because I was so obtunded from the drugs that they gave me, there's no way I could have gone by myself. But while I was there, I would get out, I would walk along the beach, I would stand underneath the trees, and I would walk those sandy roads, and something began to happen inside of me. I began to experience the power and the feel of the universe. of the higher power that controls it all. When you walk along the shore, when you hear the mighty ocean roar, when you feel the pull of the tide, or you see the seagulls in flight, or even the fiddler crabs as they run through the foam, these things didn't just happen. Something was happening inside of me. As I sat underneath the great oak tree, I experienced a feeling of peace that I had never known before. Peace. And the best way for me to describe that is the absence of fear. The absence of fear. I wasn't afraid. Fear is one common denominator of all alcoholics. I've never known an alcoholic yet that wasn't afraid. But as long as I was there, I was safe, I was secure, as I must have felt when my mother held me in her arms. I stayed there for a while. This is where I was first introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sister asked me if it would be all right, and some people came to talk to me, and I talked to them, and they said, we're going to have a meeting tonight, we want you to come. And I said, all right. And I knew I had to, because there wasn't any place else for me to go. So I went to that meeting that night, just as high as a Georgia pine. And thank goodness they didn't stop me at the door and turn me away and say, Alcoholics Anonymous is just for sober alcoholics. If I'd been rejected that night, I'd not be alive today. Don't remember a lot about what happened. This fella got up and he talked, and I met him afterwards. But and after he finished talking, they gave out some poker chips. Several people took one. I took one too. I would have taken one of each color if I thought it would have done any good. Went home, woke my sister up, and I showed her this poker chip, this white chip with AA on it. Knowing full good and well, as soon as I left, she called back to Atlanta. Our problems are solved. He's joined AA. I didn't join AA. I used AA. You see, they were talking about what they were going to do with me, and they meant for keeps. But here was my ticket out, this white poker chip. Well, I didn't drink and I didn't take drugs when I was down there. I went to a few more meetings, but the main thing that I did was I walked the beach and I stood on the bridge and watched the ships go out. And I experienced that feeling of peace and of power that is so prevalent in my life today. I came back, to go to work, and I didn't know if I'd have a job or not. It's not much of a secret what's wrong with you when you go into the DTs. But they called me to come back down to the hospital. They had a special meeting, and I went back down there, and I didn't know what I'd do or what I'd say. I didn't have to do or say anything. And this is where my friends in the medical profession almost killed me. They'd been covering up for me for a long time anyhow. And they just said, we want you to come on back and go to work with us. Now, we know you've been working these long and hard hours. And we know you've been taking this medication. We want you to come back and go to work with us, but you've got to keep it under control. My friends, at this time, I was a hopeless addict to the drug alcohol. I couldn't go over 2 hours at a time without taking a drink. This was the horror part of alcoholism, the running, the hiding, the lying, the cheating, the living in fear. You wake up in the morning and that feeling of impending doom is there. And you know that the shakes and sweats are going to come. And that you know that you've got to have a drink. That's the only thing that will stop it. Keep it under control. There was no way that I controlled it. I wasn't drinking because I wanted to. I was drinking because I had to. I went back down to the hospital. They stopped me. They sent me home. The next day I received a hand-delivered letter saying, don't ever come back to this hospital. I was fired, publicly humiliated, disgraced. Once again, I went back down to St. Simon's Island. I stayed with my sister a little bit longer. This time, I came back and I couldn't go back to work. My family had all gone. I was all alone. My family had to leave for their own safety and their own sanity. I was drinking and so depressed. I knew I no longer wanted to live the way that I was living, but I didn't know how not to drink. I went into the living room of the house with my pistol in my hand, and I never planned to leave that room. And then my moment of truth. My moment of truth. And I think we all have these moments. I was able to see myself as I really was. All the false pride, the ego, and everything was removed. And I was able to surrender as best that I could at that time. I fell on my knees and I said, God, help me. Prayer. Prayer was nothing new for me. I prayed all the time. God, do this for me and I won't do that anymore. Please, God, bargains, pleadings, promises. No. A simple cry for help. God, help me. Of course, the cry was heard, and I had thought, remembered, and had been told about this doctor that lived down in Statesboro, Georgia, about 200 miles away. I called him up, and I went down there, and I lived with Dr. John and his family in his home. In addition to him and them, there were people there just like you. And you knew that I was afraid, and you knew that I was lonely, and you knew that I was sick. You put your arms around me, and you took me into your hearts. You took me into your homes, and you loved me back to health and to sanity. And you gave me everything that I have today. It wasn't all a bed of roses down there, though. Now, Dr. John believed in withdrawing, and I withdrew with just withdrawing. Second day I was there, he came into my room. He said, we're going to a meeting tonight. And I said, Dr. John, I can't even put on my pants. And he said, we're going to a meeting tonight. So we went to a meeting that night, and I picked up the white chip that enabled me to go to the blue chip that I have today. I stayed down there a few more days, I don't know how long, maybe a week altogether. And next to the last day, I was by myself, looking out in the warm November sunlight into a little grove of pine trees, and the sun was coming in through the window panes, and I was standing there enjoying this warmth, drinking a cup of coffee, I guess. And then all of a sudden, there was this tremendous profusion of heat that completely came over my body. And accompanying it was the instant knowledge that at that moment, I was within the presence of God. And that as long as I remained so, I would never, ever have to take a drink or a drug again. I was free. I was free. That was November the 13th, 1966. And from that moment to now, I have never had, nor have I wanted, a drink of any kind. I take no credit for my sobriety, or as far as that's concerned, purely a gift from God. I left and I came back, and I went to AA this time, and I really joined AA. I did all the things that you told me to do. I went to the meetings early. I helped set up the chairs. I emptied the ashtrays. I made the coffee, and I did everything that you told me to do. I became a very visible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after a while, I got back on the hospital staff and became very active in the medical community again. And it quickly, the word went around that there was a recovered doctor that would see alcoholic patients. And so that's how I got into the treatment of alcoholism. But really, that wasn't it. The way I got into it was back in those days, and there's some of you here that remember, we made 12-step calls. And I think we miss that now. And I think that was an awesome experience. But you'd go out into a hotel or somewhere, and there would be somebody there, and they'd call AA, and usually an older member would take a younger person with them and would go in. And often it was the practice to take a half a pint of whiskey with you to give to that person, because you could get their attention if you did and talk to them. And I said, this is crazy. I've got a bag out there in my car that I can do the same thing with. And so eventually that's how I got into it. And then I got to seeing so many people that I realized it's easier for them to come to me than for me to go to them. Now, sometimes this didn't really work out, having a large gynecology practice, having a live drunk come in right in the middle. But they didn't all wait until after hours. And also, the interesting thing was they'd come and they'd call up to make an appointment. And the nurse or the receptionist would say, which one? I'm working with my father, you know. And they'd say, the alcoholic. And I don't have any anonymity, and that too is the way that I live my life. And everybody knew me when I was the drunk Dr. Hunter. I'm certainly not sorry for them to know me as the sober Dr. Hunter. And I became very active in that way. And so then later on, the hospital developed. And then I started doing workshops and seminars and things of that nature. And was very busy. I lived alone at that time. And my children were all doing fairly well. There's some interesting stories to go along with that, but we don't really have time for that. But I became very busy, and I was busy most of the time, going everywhere and traveling around, and we were successful, and I wouldn't take anything for that period of time. There are many of you here today that were in the hospital, either as patients or with staff, and I get teary when I think of those times, because it was very special. It's real interesting that, I don't know that we really knew a whole lot about what we were doing, but our intention was right, and the program that we had was AA program, and we had good medical backup. And I'm very proud of what we had there. The spirit I've never seen equaled anywhere else. And it was interesting when John did the countdown the other night, that when we got to the 20s, and the hospital is now 25 years old, and with the 20s, and I looked across the room, and I saw how many people were standing that were there at the hospital at that time. And it was just wonderful. So it was an awesome experience. I don't do that anymore, and I resigned in 1982. I'm being very disenchanted with what's happening in the medical community and in the hospitals, and I'm still that way. And that's a whole other issue, and I won't go into that now, but I'm still very busy, and I still see, like I did originally, after office hours or at home or wherever, I see alcoholics and when occasion comes up. And I do medical consulting to different hospitals and things of that nature. So, and then there's some other things that I'm real involved in. And so I'm busy most of the time and very active. The thing with the children that I do want to tell you about, though, is that how powerful an influence it was for them. And I remember coming home late one Sunday afternoon, and they were out in the yard playing catch. And they saw me, and they said, "Where are you going, Dad?" And I said, "I'm going to a meeting." And I didn't have to say what kind. They knew what kind. And I knew what they were thinking. "Come out in the yard and play with us, Dad." And they didn't say that. They said, "Have a good time, Dad. We love you, Dad. See you in the morning, Dad." And I drove on over to my meeting, and I got to thinking about what they were really telling me. These were the children that I abused. These are the children that cried all night. These are the children that couldn't tell you what happened in their house last night. Each one with that deep, dark secret inside. "Have a good time, Dad. I love you, Dad. See you in the morning, Dad." They've got a daddy now. They always loved me, but now they're proud of me. There's just so much. I moved down to the island, and I live down there now, and it's a wonderful, tranquil, powerful place to be. It's such a spiritual place. And this is such a spiritual program that we have, as Sandy said last night. And the spirit is nowhere more prevalent than it is here in this room this morning. You can feel the intrinsic power of the universe manifest itself through you people and through our wonderful program. Last year, my daughter lives in California, was coming to see me. And she has a little 4-year-old son who I'd only seen when he was a baby. And he had not seen me, but evidently she had been telling him about me. And I met him in the airport, and we were going to fly down to the beach together. And they were a good ways away, and my daughter saw me, and she spoke to her son and pointed me out to him. And so the little fellow, a little towhead, about like that, just lit up. I'm going to try to do this. Came running down the car to that busy airport, stopping people all the way. That's my grandfather. You know what that means to me. I've been given another chance. Two granddaughters and two grandsons. And they just think I'm the greatest thing that ever was. But for the grace of God and you people, I wouldn't have that today. Each morning when I wake up is a gift to me. First of all, that I wake up. And as many of you know, I've had open heart surgery twice. But I'm so grateful that I'm alive, that I'm sober, for the wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for you people. I have a choice every morning when I wake up, whether I'm going to be happy, whether I'm going to be sad, whether I'm going to drink. I don't really think about that much now. But I choose to be happy, and I choose to be with happy people and recovered people and with successful people. I absolutely refuse to be around negative people anymore. I don't have time for that in my life now. I see these beautiful flowers down here, and I love the flowers. But you know, the flowers that grow in the field will soon wither and die. But the flowers that grow in your heart will live forever. You people are the flowers that grow in the heart. I look into your faces. I look into your eyes. And I see the beauty of the soul inside. There's no question but we are God's chosen people. My life, my love, my sobriety is my gift from God. What I do with my life, what you do with your life, is your gift back to God. Remember that each and every one of you is different as the snowflake, as the flower petal. And each and every one of us is the only one of us that there is. You're needed and important. Without you, the world would not be complete. Let your light so shine that it will be a message to all people that you have the beauty, the power of recovery through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can best illustrate is saying the spirit of your higher power. Let it shine from your face so that all will know we are the beacons of the hope of the world. The beauty of your soul shines so brightly that it illuminates all of the darkness and the shadows. I don't have to live in the shadows anymore. I want to live in the sunlight. The sunlight that comes from the warmth and the glow of recovered alcoholic people. I think on this and how my life is today and what a blessing it is. The many things that you have given me. And I just have to stop and say, thank God for this difference that I first realized when I was about 12 years old. That led me to the disease of alcoholism, to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to you wonderful people. Because without that, I wouldn't be what I am today. I'm a happy alcoholic. I'm a successful alcoholic. And I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I want to thank you so much for letting me be here this morning and listening to me. You're so kind and so gentle. And I want to ask God to bless you, each and every one, and hold you so gently in the hollow of His hand, where your name is already written. And to this God of mine I say, how great Thou art. Thank you.